This is The Guardian.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly. Joy for the Tartan Army. The last time they scored twice in the dying minutes to take the lead in a qualifier, they Norsed it up by letting one in injury time against England. This time, the only Norsing was from the Norse players on the pitch, the shattered Norwegians down on their haunches. We'll cover England's win in Malta, yet more Trent Alexander-Arnold chat. Is any player talked about more? Disaster for Wales against Armenia. Ireland carry on being not very good, and Northern Ireland lose a tight one in Denmark. Spain win the Nations League, sneaking past Croatia on penalties. In transfer news, Ruben Neves takes the Saudi coin. Arteta talks to PSG, presumably to say, not a chance, thank you, you lunatics. And Erik ten Hag is angry about not buying anyone. It's goodbye Martin Tyler. Hello Peter Drury. Let's hope he's not as biased against insert the name of your team you support as his predecessor. All that plus your questions. And that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Jordan Jarrett Bryan, welcome.
Morning, mate. How are you?
I'm very good. Hello, John Bruin.
Hello, Max. Is it that you're not on social media that means you're speaking in a very brisk, business-like fashion? Is this a new you?
Was that too quick?
It just rattled through that intro.
Like, oh, wow.
You know, it's like a newsreader on, you know, local news or something like that.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Well, that doesn't sound like a compliment to at all, does it? It's where I'll end up. Look east, here we come. Hello, Lars Sivertsen.
Max, you sound refreshed.
Obviously. Well, we'll get to that, my pompous, virtuous social media break. Nicholas said I had a vasectomy on Friday, and the physician and nurse were offended that I was going to listen to the pod rather than chat with them. I decided that as it was a Nations League pod, small talk and cauterization was probably preferable and less painful. We will get to the Nations League, but first, Scotland, the most exciting moment of the weekend. Barca Jim joins us. Hello, Jim. Jim Burke.
Hello, Max. Hello, boys. How are we?
Really good, and not meant in a patronising sense. I know you think I patronise the Scots, Jim. I don't, you're not helping me here. But that was, that. Those last 2 minutes, the commentators, I think it was the Sky commentators, just losing their shit when Kenny McLean scored. It was a brilliant finish, but what a moment.
I actually didn't see the game because I was gigging on Saturday night, and I've got the alerts on my phone, right, or my watch, right? So I knew there was only a couple of minutes to go. Up comes live score, goal. We've equalised. Like, yes, we've equalised. Then a minute later, another goal flashed, and I thought, yeah, we've Scotland it, lads. We've Scotland it. We've equalised and then thrown it away in the very last minute. And then I scrolled up, and it was like, no, we haven't. We scored. Oh, it was absolutely fantastic. Fantastic. It's just... I mean, Lars, I mean, how does it feel to be Scottish this morning?
I mean, I'd almost written off this qualifying campaign for us after the Georgia draw because I'm prone to defeatism when it comes to these things. But this was quite horrifying. But it's something I sort of thought about before the game, which is, We obviously have the headline acts of Erling Haaland and Martin Ødegaard and a couple of other names people will recognise, but we are very dodgy at the back on paper, and it proved so on the pitch as well.
Jim, in terms of sort of historic Tartan Army moments, sort of in recent history, what, there's France away with that belter in the top corner, but I can't think of too many moments that are up there with this.
Not in terms of snatching a victory from the jaws of defeat. We are masters of the converse, do you know what I mean? We can get ourselves in a fantastic position and then nose it up completely. So I'm really struggling to remember a time where we weren't Scottish, as in we're 1-0 down and it plays out and there is no chance of any kind of redemption whatsoever. It's amazing. Absolutely amazing.
That's just like still your buzzing. Giddiness.
I'm still buzzing.
And I mean, I love a goal rolling in, John, like Lyndon Dykes, where everyone can see what's going to happen, especially the lad going down with cramp. I think he probably did have cramp. Jim doesn't think he did. I think Lars probably thinks he did. But that was just the Norwegian, just everyone could see what was going to happen, but no one could do anything about it.
I believe him on the cramp thing. We're talking about the equaliser, Leo Østigård, who, if you watch the highlights, you watch the game, you'll notice it is one of those where it looks like your defender has just, like, the MacBook is trying to do too much at the same time, and you get the spinny wheel of death. It's like, and you hear the, yeah, it looks like that's happened. He just kind of freezes. And he explained to Leo Østigård afterward that it was just, he suddenly got a cramp in both his legs, and his legs were not responding to commands, which sounds absurd, I guess, for a professional footballer. But the thing is, Østigård, I think he's completed 90 minutes twice or something for his club in 2023. Like, he's not a regular for Napoli, so he's not used to playing 90 minutes of football. So you can see why that might happen. Goal. And then for the second goal, actually, listening to the coach, Ståle Solbakken, after the game, I think he was angrier about the second goal, because an individual mistake, tired legs, okay, as a coach, you just have to take that, I guess. But for the second goal, everyone kind of rushed. I think people had kind of got, oh no, we've got to get this back somehow. And they were kind of rushing ahead, and suddenly there was just a massive gap on that left flank. There was just no one there. Everyone had run away, which is not what you want to see. Because even as disappointing as 1-1 would be, where we would have been slightly less dead in the group with the draw, at least, you know. So miserable stuff all around.
In fairness, Lars, the reason they probably ran up the park was somebody said, lads, it's Scotland, right? Because they're thinking, this is not what Scotland do. We know if we press them, we're going to get the winner. So I wouldn't be as harsh on your lads for that, because history tells us that they probably would have scored the winner.
John, is Scotland good?
I feel like I say this quite often on the pod, is that Steve Clarke's a really good manager and has done a great job for Scotland. And that idea of Scotland being there or thereabouts, he's taken them closer. Okay, they only qualified for the Euros, you know, missed out on the World Cup, but it does feel that they're a much more solid outfit. And if you are a team like Norway, and let's face it here, Lars, you've got Odegaard, you've got Haaland, and then you've got nine other mopes. You know, you're thinking you're going to be on the end of something here from Scotland, because And actually, you know, there are players there playing at high quality. McGinn plays his part in that winning goal, which was a beauty, by the way. It was, you know, a great piece of teamwork. And I don't see why Scotland shouldn't be, if we've got a 24 team Euros, I think we've stopped at now these days, I don't see why they shouldn't be at that. I think they're, you know, and I say, Steve Clarke, excellent manager. Underrated guy, I'm told, away from his very publicly, how do we put this, dour outlook. He is one of the funniest people you can meet. You know, great. And yeah, I can only pay tribute to Steve Clarke and the players he's got. And Scotland have brought through some good players. And when, Jim will know this, 10 years ago or so, we had the likes of Gordon Strachan talking about how Scottish people were too small or weren't quick enough, and there seems to be some sort of eugenics that Gordon was talking about then. But thankfully, Steve Clarke's proven that wasn't absolutely necessary.
Yeah, Andy Robertson after the game was talking about, I think he was asked the question, are you now through? Do you think you should be qualified? And he said, yes. He said, if we don't qualify from here on in, we failed. I don't know if, I think I might be paraphrasing there, but I think they've got Georgia next. Is that correct? You've got Georgia next. So you'd like to think that they can get at least a draw there. The mere fact they've beaten Norway away if they can get at least a draw at home, I think he's probably correct there. But I find it interesting that he was so bullish in coming forward and saying, we, you know, 9 points, 3 from 3. If we don't qualify from here on in, we've bogged it up.
Jim, do you, how do you feel when you hear a Scottish player talking in that way?
I'm not comfortable with it. Let's just put it that way. You know, I can't begin to say, look, we're not conditioned for it. You know, that's one of the things that when England are in a tournament, that you, English, certain English pundits have that sense of entitlement about them, that where your natural place is. You know, since 1978, Scotland, we've known where our natural place is, right? And it's not at the top table. So it's, but the Georgia game is by no means a foregone conclusion. It's, I mean, they've only lost one in their last 16. They beat Bulgaria 5-2 away in the Nations League. You know, they're, you know, it's not, it's really not a foregone conclusion. And I'm, you know, my giddiness will wear off in about an hour and a half. And then, and then the pre-Georgia nerves will settle in, you know.
Before you go, Jim, Brendan Rodgers back to Celtic. How are you feeling?
Conflicted in truth, right? Conflicted in truth. As you know, Max, the you know that the my feelings about Big Ange leaving have not subsided, and your integral part in that whole process. Still, there is a punishment due, and that punishment will come.
I will accept it.
But no, I'm happy because I was at a pal's funeral on Friday, and it was all the Celtic lads were there, and I say 90% of them were behind it, but one guy, he was just not having it. Should be nowhere near the club. And I said to him, look, it's Celtic. It's the Scottish Premier League. We've got a guy who took Leicester to 2 top 5 finishes, took them to a Europa League semi-final, and won an FA Cup. And arguably his last year was because the owners pulled the rug financially on him. You know, and to get a man with that CV who also knows the club, who knows Scottish football, you know, I've had to put quite a lot of bitterness behind me, you know, so that I can embrace this new, you know, our very own managerial Jake Humphreys taking the reins again for the second time.
Actually, Jordan, I wanted to get your thoughts on Postecoglou in a sort of hot take mould. Are you slightly nervous that that's a good decision? Tottenham had a good decision.
I actually am. I won't profess to being an expert on him, but I've done some reading up on him, and his track record seems to be solid. And I like the way that he's quite bullish. My only thing for Spurs, though, would be I'm not entirely sure it matters who the manager is. I think it's the person above the manager that ultimately has to find out and work out what kind of club he wants Spurs to be. Is it about making money as a priority? Is it about playing good football? Is it about winning trophies? And I think until Daniel Levy and his colleagues in the boardroom really ascertain what it is they want Tottenham Hotspur to be, you know, Guardiola could go there, and I still think there'd be limitations in what Spurs could achieve. But I think it's a good appointment. I'm interested to see him in the Prem. He seems to be a character. You know that more than most. But I'm not sure if the ceiling that he can achieve will be fulfilled because of what's happening above him.
Yeah, Jordan, I hear what you're saying, but I do not believe that Ange would have taken the job without assurances about what he would be allowed to do. Because although his CV on paper is not it's Australia, Japan, Scotland, he does not suffer from any lack of self-belief and self, you know, he's got a very, very defined and profound vision. And I genuinely don't think he would have let the discussions go any further if he didn't get the assurances that he wants. Yeah, so I think that I can understand from the outside that's how it would look. But from what I heard through my, you know, people I know at Celtic, it was a case that this is now my club. This runs the way I want it to run. And I would be very, very surprised if he hasn't asked for the same assurances Spurs.
Look, we're at risk of talking about football that people care about, and this is specifically a Nations League Euro qualifiers podcast. So, Jim, enjoy your hour and a half of giddiness and enjoy the Georgia game later. Thanks for coming on,
mate. Excellent. Listen, nice to see you all again, guys. See you later, boys.
Cheers, Jim.
Bye-bye.
Barca Jim Burke there. Let's do the England game then. They beat Malta 4-0. Trent Alexander-Arnold. I feel sorry for who has to come up with these stats. Becomes the first Liverpool player to score from outside the box for England in a competitive international since Steven Gerrard against Moldova in September 2013. Hopefully not a full-time job for whoever that is, just sitting there going, Gerrard, and then just waits every England game for the next decade until he does it. But, John, the most interesting part, I'm really conscious that he's talked about so much, but the most interesting part of this game was him playing in midfield and playing really well.
Yeah. And it's something that it's become a culture war, hasn't it? The discussion of whether Trent can play midfield. My view has often been that, okay, he's played as a defender for 5-6 years. How easy is it to walk into midfield and learn all the other traits of midfield, which are tracking runners, switching positions, covering positions. You know, it's a different discipline. Now, the only thing with that is that when Trent was brought into the team, he was brought in because he was Trent Alexander-Arnold. Can I call him by his full name? I think I can. Yeah. When Trent Alexander-Arnold was brought in, it was because he was the most promising youngster. They needed in the team. They thought he needed a run in the team. Put him at right back. It's a fairly old style means of putting a player into a team. He just happens to be really good at it, or one aspect. Do England need a playmaker who is gliding passes across the pitch in the manner that he is? I'm not sure that is a particularly modern way of football, and against a team other than Malta, it would be quite so effective. But in a game like that, he took his chance, played very well, and gave Gareth Southgate, he made Gareth Southgate think that that's a possibility in the future. But it did remind me a little bit of the old David Beckham quarterback thing. Do you remember this? When Bex decided that everyone else was rubbish in the team, he wasn't particularly incorrect in that, and he was going to sit and drift and switch play and all this type of thing. I'm not sure it worked then. Let's see how it works at, and this is the truth, isn't it? England need to win the big games against the biggest teams. Would you fancy Trent Alexander-Arnold, to give him his full name, playing in that position in those matches? I'm not sure yet, but it's a possibility.
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, I would prefer, of all England right-backs, probably better him than, I don't know, Rob Jones or Paul Parker giving it a try. But John makes a really good point, Lars, about the different skills you need, right? And one of those is like taking the ball in really tight areas. When you're at right back, you tend to have time on the ball when you get it. I think his first touch is good enough, but you sort of think at that elite level that if you're constantly doing this, and I guess in training, they're all playing in, you know, these little tight six-a-side matches, you learn all those skills. But that's the point, isn't it? It's enticing Alexander-Arnold, Rice and Bellingham as a three, but do you do that against Germany in the semi-final of the Euros?
Yeah, I feel like that's kind of like let's cross that bridge when we get to it. But it's also an element of, yes, at fullback, yes, the game is mostly in front of you. So you're definitely not worrying about what's out to the right, because usually that is the sideline. And then you have to the left and in front of you is where the game is happening. Whereas if you're in central midfield, you have to have a much more sort of 360-degree awareness of what's going on and to be able to turn quickly. And as John said, track runners, know where you're meant to be in the shape. You know, you can't just plonk a guy into midfield and say, you're a midfielder now, because you're good at missing the ball. It is a little bit more complicated. But I think it's certainly worth trying. And it's worth noting that when he was playing very well as a fullback at Liverpool, you know, if you look at positionally on the pitch, like he would get into that sort of right-hand channel very often anyway. And that was a big part of how Liverpool played. I forget who. We did actually have a tweet before the show about how we Like we obsess over positions. Yeah.
I've got it here. It's Pete says, given the talk around Trent playing in midfield, Stones playing in midfield, etc., do you think people get too hung up on what position people play? And should we acknowledge that traditional positions have changed and players need to be flexible with?
Yeah, 100%. Because the thing, you know, the thing that people do now with Stones' role at City has kind of flummoxed the people who put the formation down on paper before the game. Because he has one position when the team has the ball and a completely different one when they don't. So what kind of formation do you put down? And it doesn't matter, but it's an interesting little thing. I think you see some actually put him in midfield now in the lineup because that's where he is with the ball. If you go back a couple of years to when Liverpool were flying under Jurgen Klopp and Trent Alexander-Arnold was playing at right back, you kind of do a similar thing with that and put him in a completely different part of the field, because when they had the ball, he would always go forward and end up often in that sort of right-hand channel area of the field. So in that sense, that's not a huge change. But it is different. But defending in that part of the field against a good opponent, but I do like that this was tried against Malta. I mean, this felt like an enormously pointless game. I mean, I'm a big fan of international football, but this break after the club season has just finished, I don't know, man. It's difficult to get hyped for. But at least if we're gonna have these games, might as well try something new. But I would like to see them try it. Against Ukraine away in the qualifying in September, but then also when they play Italy in October, that's when you have actually a game that matters a little bit, even though they're very, very comfortable in the group, of course. But you have a couple of games coming up against slightly stronger opponents, and I would like to see this tried then.
Interesting point. It's really the graphics department at TV studios who are upset because they can't just put up a graphic going, this is the team, because people move around. Your thoughts on it, Jordan?
Yeah, I find this Trent thing quite interesting as well, because I heard a discussion on the radio a few days ago that was talking about it. And the point that was being made by the journalists that were talking was that they feel that he's technically good enough and he has the intelligence to play that role. But also he's playing with players that, at their clubs, be it Arsenal, City or Liverpool, many of whom play a variation of that type of inverted fullback in midfield anyway. My kind of, I guess, pushback would be the reason why it works so well at Manchester City is because they're able to work on it and coach it every single day for a year. Southgate doesn't have these players for every single day leading up to the Euros. So whilst I understand what he's trying to do, and I think it works, I think he was brilliant, caveating it was Malta, no disrespect. When it gets to the real meat and gravy, if you like, with a bit of gravy, of the tournament next year in Germany against the best teams, do we have enough time to ensure that that works well? That would be my only concern. And I think, and it's only a guess, the gap that Southgate was thinking about whether to re-sign a contract to go on to another tournament, I think he was wondering to himself, in the next tournament or two, am I going to take a risk or change what I've been doing to going forward? Or am I going to, trusting the last two tournaments have gone pretty well and there's no need for wholesale changes? And I think that time he took to kind of think about it was whether he was going to listen to people that were saying, you've got to change it. Or stick to his guns. And it seems to me that he's prepared to change it here. I just question whether there's enough time on the training field for him to really implement that to be successful come Germany next year.
I feel that you did disrespect Malta there.
I did a little bit.
Yeah, I was getting that. Yeah.
Yeah, I was getting that vibe. And, if it was Mark Langdon, it would definitely be the meat and gravy of the tournament. That's been clear about that. Anyway, that'll do for part one. Part two, we'll begin with the Nations League final.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. Carl said, did anyone approach Nations League guru Barry at his local last night and ask, why on earth are they playing extra time and not just putting us out of our misery? Lars, even you didn't have Nations League fever last night.
I didn't. I feel it often falls to me to be the one who's like, this is actually really interesting, you guys. You know, look at Modric and his, look at that, Danny Olmo's kind of some fun players here. But no, I was struggling. I was really struggling. And I kind of hate this, like, shouldn't go on a podcast to talk about football to explain how much you didn't enjoy watching the football. That's nonsense. No one's listening for that. But I've also got to be honest, I did not get hyped for the Nations League. I do think the Nations League is a successful concept. I think it works really well. I think if you look at what the various countries want, the bigger countries want more meaningful games against strong opponents, check. Mid-ranking countries are kind of looking for more ways to qualify to tournaments, check. And the smaller countries, they get more meaningful games against similar level. I mean, it's great. It ticks all the boxes. I just worry about the timing of this sort of finals, because I've not gotten the sense that many people have cared about it. That said, I don't have any family members who are like Croatian or Spanish, so it's entirely possible that I'm disrespecting huge swaths of our listeners now, who for whom yesterday was a huge occasion. This could be true.
But I think actually sometimes we get sort of caught up with how important this is and that is and et cetera. And when you look at the crowd, John, not every one of them has to be a football obsessive, but they really, you know, if your team are there, you support them and they win a penalty shootout. It's not everyone going to Edgbaston loves every minute of Test cricket, but it's a great day out and you support your team. And that is a good thing. And you could see at the end, obviously, you get carried away with what's happening in front of you. The game wasn't great, but a penalty shootout is always great.
Yeah, the shootout was great. Although I have a theory now that footballers are getting too good at penalties. But it's like, yeah, that this idea of, you know, obviously we as proud Englishmen, well, was this idea of it's a lottery, you don't practice or whatever. But teams do practice it clearly, and they're bloody good at them. And it's a surprise when anyone misses or saves. Simon made two brilliant saves, you have to say, for a penalty shot. This game, I went on for so long, and it felt like it dragged on the season. It felt like it had gone on for so long that we had to bring back characters from the past. So Hosolu suddenly has reappeared in football, yeah? And Mikel Merino. So it went on for so long that we're dredging back sort of walk-on parts from Newcastle from about 6 or 7 years ago. And it just suddenly like... And then halfway through the game, they announced that Hosolu signed for Real Madrid. I mean, come on. this game had dropped into this vortex of absolute nothingness that it just started stirring out.
Yeah, that's great.
Stirring out chaos theory so that we could be entertained. Because on the field, let's be quite frank here, chaps, nothing was going to happen, was it, until the penalty shootout from the very early stages.
I
was going to say, Andros Townsend, friend of the show, obviously, his enthusiasm, wow. You know, I want Andros around if I'm feeling down. It was great.
And that's the point, is if you're doing, there's different, right, we can go, this was good and this was shit. If your job is to host the game, you can't go, I just don't give a, I don't give one about this. You know, I'm here to work on my broadcasting career, frankly. You don't care.
No, you did well.
Care.
You did really well. Yeah, you did really well. But it was like,
I feel like I can't really make fun of Joselu because he had his sort of, you know, incredible. He was called up to the senior squad for the first time at the age of 33, and this is great. And then he came off the bench and he scored two goals in his first. Yes, but that was against Norway, so I did not enjoy that. It was earlier this year. It's not been a great year for us, but he was there. Luka Modric tired? Question mark. Is are we doing this still? I mean, he still looks good to me.
I was going to say actually, Joselu is like a Spanish Ricky Lambert without the great awakening. Let's put it that way.
Well, we don't know that yet, do we? Let's wait for a few years. I wonder if it was for Real Madrid. Is that like a Weghorst sort of sign? This just seems strange.
Yeah.
To come in for Benzema, right? That can't be it for Real Madrid.
Well, he's gone into double figures in La Liga every year for the last 4 years, playing for like Alaves and Espanyol. So, I mean, he's clearly got something about him, and you need... I'm going to go ahead and guess that Joselu is not Real Madrid starting number nine when the season kicks off, but you need an option up front, don't you?
Yeah.
It's like City signing Che Adams or something like
that. I reckon he'd get a few, to be fair, Che. I mean,
Jordan,
a word on Croatia, right? I mean, it does feel, not that this is the Euros or the World Cup, but it would have been nice if this Croatia team could have lifted a trophy after, given everything that they have sort of given to football with a tiny population and just that three in midfield.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, you're nicer than me, so I guess.
You just don't care? There's no place for romance in this?
No, unless I'm involved in the romance, then no. I mean...
No romance for anyone. Only me.
is that literally for no one on
just
earth?
Just me.
Birth rates will plummet under the JJB plan.
Yes. Just he strolls through the park and there's a young lovers sitting on a bench and just like, nah, it's not me. There's no love.
Yeah. I guess we'll go with it. It would have been nice for them to win it. I don't particularly care. Listen, they've done really well in the last handful of tournaments, and if you're a Croatian, you'd have liked to crown that with something. And if you're a nice person like you are, Max, it'd have been good to see as well. But I don't really care about any other nation or team apart from the ones that I support. So, sorry.
Right. So there we are. There's the probable end of quite a few Croatia players. And that's their tribute, I'm afraid. Italy beat Netherlands 3-2 in the third place playoff. If we're talking about, I mean, games that didn't need to happen, the third place playoff of the Nations League of a Sunday afternoon. Not fair on anyone. In games that do matter, Wales, John, against Armenia. I mean, this was bleak, wasn't it? I didn't even have the heart to message Ellis and ask for a voice note. I just couldn't do it.
No. I watched the highlights package of this, and it's with Dean Saunders as co-commentator, and you know, Dean Saunders is a very engaging chap, as we know. And it started off with, he goes, "There's no reason why Wales shouldn't just blow this lot away, you know." And just, you know, and then obviously it's a 6 or 7 minute highlights reel, and it just cuts through, and then by the end he is just destroying. He's like, "Why has he not chased that down?" And like, it is. Yeah, just seen through the eyes of Dean Saunders, it was an utter disaster. And actually, beyond that, in Wales, it's been seen as a wide disaster. And, you know, Rob Page, someone that I think on the pod and everyone has agreed has done a fine job stepping in difficult circumstances. Bit of pressure on him. He's been on a horrible run. Not great, really, is it, to see them, I suppose, it might be expected in the post Bale days, and the fact that Bale towards the end of his time was on the way out anyway, but not pleasant. But I think I've got a feeling that a few people, and Lars probably agree with this, have underestimated Armenia in the time. Quite a talented team, I think.
Yeah, there's a couple of decent players in there, and I like their coach, Alexander Petrakov, because he was. I jest. I mean, it's obviously a very horrible situation, but he attempted to sign up to the defense of Ukraine. He wanted to go fight in the war. But, you know, he's in his 60s and has no military background. So they were like, "Listen, we appreciate the spirit, old man, but this is maybe not for you." And he's gone off.
It's an amazing story, isn't it?
Yeah. And that is, I mean, I don't know what it feels like to have your country invaded. I suppose quite a few people probably would react in that way. But yeah, quite a spirited individual, no doubt. But no, there's some very tidy technical players in the Armenia team. So obviously they're a team you hope to get a result against. But if they were completely dismissive about it early doors, then they deserved what came after.
And to finish, Kiefer Moore is sending off. It was this terrible tangle with a goalie. Reminded a bit of Beckham and Diego Simeone, but a bit more malice to it. the goalkeeper did make a, you know, the acrobatics from tearing himself out were quite something, it has to be said.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose keepers dive around a lot, don't they? So they've got, they sort of know, they know that if they land, they'll be okay because they're sort of practiced at it.
Yeah,
yeah. But he went down. He didn't get up to save the rebound, did he? That quickly, he may have done. But look, their goals were great. Actually, Ramos's two were good finishes. And the first goal from Zelarayan was a beautiful volley into the top corner. But yeah, Rob Page just sort of said, "Look, it's a blip, and we go again." They play Turkey tonight, so they need to bounce back. Lars, you, some more info on that, the guy who scored the volley.
Well, just Lucas Zelarayan, who is the very well-regarded playmaker of the Columbus Crew in MLS, who's actually born in Argentina, but has Armenian heritage through his father and is playing for Armenia. A bit of a commute, I guess, but yeah, it's a very, very good player and a good example of what you're just saying. He's a very technically tidy player. I suspect his sort of best goals YouTube thing is quite good. He scored some bangers in MLS the last few years.
Republic of Ireland lost in Greece. I presume you don't care, Jordan. They are... Stephen Kenny, again, actually, unlike Rob Page has sort of credit in the bank, you feel. But I don't know if Stephen Kenny does. A lot of people didn't really want him to get the job in the first place. He had a lot of time. He was trying to change the style of this team.
It's been a philosophical discussion, hasn't it? Of, you know, shall Ireland at last change the style of play from the style of play that we recognise Ireland of, which is, it's not Jack Charlton, but it's essentially direct football, to a more passing style of play. One of the issues is that football has actually become more direct at the top level in the time since Stephen Kenny's trying to pull this around. And the issue, I believe, in Ireland, chatting to friends over there, you know, got some close friends over there, is that Ireland fans are looking at the fact they're bringing through good players and that they're not actually seeing enough of the ball and aren't playing well. So a player like Evan Ferguson, you know, one of the breakout players of the Premier League season, they can't get the ball to him. Now, that's a problem, isn't it? And listen, I think there's always been a lobby in Ireland that Stephen Kenny should never have got the job, but they wanted him out from the very start. I think that's growing now. They play Gibraltar. Now, if they lose that, well, obviously that is the end. It seems unlikely that they would lose that. But you have to fear for Stephen Kenny, the boss man Steo, as we should always refer to him.
Having no skin in this game at all, it's an international football thing, and I know a thing or two about this, being from a smaller country, is that you are kind of beholden to the generation of players that you have in front of you, right? So you guys, without cheating, can you name a central, you know, they played with three midfielders in this game, Ireland. Can you name one of them without looking it up?
Andy Townsend.
Jason Malumbi.
Ah, see, there we go, because of all your Irish friends, John Bruin. Very good. My point being more, your midfield is Colin Smallbone and Malumbi. You know, yeah, there's a reason you can't get the ball to Evan Ferguson. Some of these guys are a bit younger, and maybe if you give them time, they'll grow into something. But with this whole Stephen Kenny discourse, it's not as if you put, like, Neil Warnock in there and knock it long, suddenly you'll become a brilliant team. Like, there is a group of players that has some pretty strong limitations.
And look, that's an interesting point you make. Like, Northern Ireland have a sort of similarly, like, even more of a sort of hodgepodge squad, don't they? Akers says, I was at the pub on Friday for the Northern Ireland game. We went wild with ecstasy when the last minute goal went in, only to have to sit down again after it was disallowed. What are the most embarrassing circumstances you've celebrated a goal only to see it disallowed? Brings me back memories of my friend Matt Walsh, from a Man City fan, who was in a pub full of Spurs fans in that City Spurs game in the Champions League. And he sort of went Neanderthal when, was it Sterling scored? And yeah. And it took a long time and then had to sit there in absolute silence. It was great. But that was a long old wait for the Northern Ireland fans. They thought it was a 6 minute or something offside call. A 1-0 defeat, Lars, at Denmark is not a disgrace, is it?
No. And I mean, I guess that's... I guess that's what you do if you're Northern Ireland. You try to stay compact and keep it tight and make it difficult. And, you know, Denmark didn't create a ton of massive chances, but they kind of got there in the end. And I guess this isn't, if you look at the group, Denmark away isn't where you're expecting to get your points here if you're Northern Ireland, but it's still kind of, there's something there for them, I think, because if you look at the group, yeah, you expect Denmark to win that, but you've got Kazakhstan, Finland, Slovenia, and San Marino, right? Kazakhstan, Finland, and Slovenia are all teams, I think, Northern Ireland, if things break a little bit in their favor and if they're at their best, they can get results against. So, you know, there's possibilities here still, I think.
Well, we'll cover all of tonight's qualifiers on tomorrow's pod. And it's worth congratulating USMNT, who beat Canada in the CONCACAF Nations League final. Successive CONCACAF Nations League titles. Following Balogun and Chris Richards scored their first international goals, two assists for now back in the group, Gio Reyna. Their semi-final was very controversial, 3-0 win over Mexico, but the game was abandoned, they were taken off the pitch very late on in the game because of homophobic chanting, and four players were sent off in that game. I don't know if you, did you see this, Lars?
So the CONCACAF final was last night, and it started at an hour where I wanted to watch it, but I would have been even less exciting to listen to in this podcast than I have, which is saying something. So yeah, I decided not. But I do note that the US went with a very attacking lineup. You had a midfield three of Gio Reyna, Yunus Musa, who can play as the anchor, but he's more of a number eight, and Brendan Aaronson in the midfield three. That is quite gung-ho, I think, in a final against local rivals Canada, who are not bad at the moment. You know, we remember from the World Cup, Canada are a quite capable team. So brave team selection from the US, rewarded in a win. And looking at sort of clips on the internet this morning, it seemed like the players, for them certainly, the CONCACAF Nations League appears to have mattered quite a lot. And I guess that's if you play your local rivals in a very tetchy game in the semis, and then Canada in the final, that adds a little bit of spice to proceedings.
All right, that'll do for part two. We'll look at some transfer stuff in part three. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. Arteta talking to PSG, Jordan. I mean, this has got to be...
About what?
About what is a good question. The thought that anybody... I mean, it's got to be nonsense, right? But the thought that anybody would go from what he has built at Arsenal to the bin fire that is Paris Saint-Germain, I mean, it would be absolutely hilarious.
For you, maybe. A bit, you know, less so for me. But I think it has been... This morning, kind of poo-pooed from what I've seen anyway, and it doesn't make any sense. So I don't think that would go any further. They're looking for a manager, and I think they're looking at different types of managers. And Arteta's had a good season, and it makes sense they'd be linked with him. But he's building something at Arsenal, as you say. Apart from a bucket load of cash, I don't see any other reason, which is a good reason to be fair. But no other reason why he would move over there. There's stability at Arsenal. There isn't at Paris Saint-Germain. He's in a competitive league. It's not competitive in France. So I expect this to be to not go anywhere. But I think that who they do appoint, I am keen to see, because they've done the experience, world-class managers. They tried something with, forgive me for forgetting his name.
Yeah, Christophe Gauthier. Yeah.
Yes, who was highly regarded in France, and it hasn't really worked out there. So I'm keen to kind of see what direction they go in going forward.
That is interesting, actually, because I remember when Gauthier got the job, but even Philippe was like, actually, this seems worryingly sensible. And even worryingly sensible, Lars, didn't work. Is it Luis Enrique, who's obviously been touted for every job now? It looks like he's chatting to them.
So the funny thing about Gauthier was that everyone said, yeah, worryingly sensible. And then for the first few months, it looked like, oh, maybe his sort of, you know, solid old school fundamental approach is getting results. And then halfway through the season, it kind of derails and you have exactly the same problems that you always have, because the dressing room is essentially unmanageable and the squad is put together by people who don't understand football. It would be funny if Arteta went there and they did like a new Amazon sort of behind the scenes thing. I would pay so much money to watch him sort of draw the heart and the brain holding hands and just cut immediately to what Mbappe and Neymar makes of it. I mean, that would be tremendous. It's just such a perfect thing for him at Arsenal, where he has a group of young players who seem to hold him in extremely high regard and will run through walls for him. And, you know, why would you do anything other than want to build on that? Luis Enrique, another one who's just, how's that going to work? Because you keep hearing these things, people suggest that PSG want to be less of a dumpster fire. Like they want to be less of a clown car and they want to sign more sensible players and hire sensible managers. But I just worry that when push comes to shove, star power is just too strong in that dressing room. Luis Enrique, I'm sure we'll have Sid on to talk about him more at some point, but he is a very strong character. You know, he's a very principled individual. He's not afraid of ruffling feathers. He's not afraid of having digs at the media, not afraid of doing, you know, making tough decisions in team selections. He's one of those dudes who does like Iron Man stuff on the side, like the biking and running for ages. And all that. He's,
oh, I see that Iron Man, not like getting into a sort of metal suit and flying.
He doesn't cosplay as the Marvel character Iron Man, though. That is another thing I would pay good money to watch. So he, on the surface of it, chucking him into that possibly unmanageable PSG dressing room sounds like a terrible idea, but you're also waiting for the time where PSG actually managed to, maybe they're able to send Neymar off to Saudi Arabia and they can put some players together that are willing to run a bit more, and then you can have, you know, Messi has gone, so there is an opportunity there to put together a team that makes more sense. But I would tend to think that PSG will remain PSG, and if they do, then I don't think Luis Enrique is going to have a great time there.
John, what do you make of the idea of Havertz to Arsenal?
Until Mikel Arteta turned round Arsenal, I'd have said Havertz is the most Arsenal player that you could possibly get. And now I do wonder whether he has the moral fibre and moral courage to be an Arsenal player, to be that player to run through brick walls for Arteta, because I do think... But actually, that could be a good fit. If Arteta could make him that player with all the talent he's got... It could be a good fit. They do seem keen on him. That one's been around for a while. But it does. I am reminded a bit of when Arsene Wenger started collecting number 10s. Remember that? When they used to have... who do they have? You know, Kleb. They had Riziki. They had... God, my memory. What's this? The Spanish guy, Cazorla, very good player.
Cazorla, Achavin.
Yeah. Yeah, but all the same. But it felt like they were all there at the same time. They obviously weren't. But if that type of player, and but having described him as a number 10 player, I'm not sure he's a number 10 player, because I've watched Kai Havertz for a few years. Nobody knows what his best position is. Least of all him, I suspect.
It's a really good point, John, because I've heard a lot of discussion about this potential transfer over the last few days. And a lot of pundits are sort of talking about, well, we've never really seen much of him from Chelsea, blah, blah. The thing that's weird is that when he came from at Leverkusen, he was seen as much more of a midfielder, and maybe an attack-minded one, but a midfielder, definitely, who would... I mean, I made the joke when he signed that, and I'm going to remake it now because people probably don't remember, that because he's from Leverkusen, his playing style was as if you put a Michal Ballack and Dimitar Berbatov in a blender and just kind of reassembled what came out of it, because he had that sort of bursting from midfield like Ballack would always do, but he had a much more languid sort of brilliant fur touch, but kind of slightly style, right? So he was kind of a love child of those two, and from Leverkusen, so that made perfect sense. But of course at Chelsea, because they've got so many sort of vaguely attacking midfielders, and they've had no functioning number nine throughout the time he's been there, he's ended up having to play striker by default a lot. And I'm not sure it really suits him. I don't think it's ever really happened. And we've never seen him play consistently in his best position in a team that actually works. That's not something I think we've seen at Chelsea. So it would be really interesting to see if Arteta could find a way, because he is a guy who's got so much going for him in terms of his skill set. It's just very, very clear that we've never seen the best of him in England, and I don't think it's all his fault.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think this goes back to what we said earlier in the pod about football not being defined in terms of positions anymore. I think he's a player that can... He plays football. He's a very good footballer. He's a very intelligent football player. On the face of it, there's no obvious fit for him in the team. But I can only imagine Arteta wants to use him as an alternative to Odegaard. That's what I think he would use him as. I don't think he'll be an alternative to Gabriel Jesus. I agree with Lars. I think he's played that striker role because they've had no alternative. They've had nothing else. So you can kind of attack and you're kind of tall. Go on, you go up front. And it's almost killed him. He's had a really bad season at Chelsea, but I don't think that's in part, as Lars says, mainly to him. So I don't see where he plays other than as a replacement for Martin Odegaard. But I don't think I think we should look less to where's the obvious position for him and more to what is the system that Arteta's trying to employ at Arsenal, and can players be adaptable to those systems, of which I think he can.
Obviously, loads of gossip doing the rounds about Caicedo and Chelsea trying to get him possibly and trying to sell their entire midfield and attack at the moment.
To Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, possibly. Well, Ruben Neves is going there, going to Al Hilal for £47 million. Is he the sort of youngest, you know, top player? Like,
the thing is, Ruben Neves has quite a long career because he was captain of Porto at 18, wasn't he? And I've, every summer there is a Ruben Neves link with, and it would be one of Liverpool, Chelsea, Manchester United. It never comes off. I remember there was a certain tranche of Manchester United fans who were obsessed with him a couple of years ago that he was going to go there. But, listen, speak to Wolves fans, I'll tell you what a good player he's been for them. But I'm never quite sure he's of the top of most of the top of most class. Not particularly quick, all the touches, very skillful player.
Hits a good volley that from a corner that's headed out to the edge of the box. That's sort of what you're getting, aren't you? You're getting two or three absolute bangers a season, and then
he'd be amazing at Soccer Aid. Yeah,
yeah, really, really good.
He'd be really good at Soccer Aid, but you know, and listen, maybe that's the type of player that's suited to the Saudi league or what they're trying to do over there. But he is one of those players, obviously closely associated with Jorge Mendes, that you would call an agency player. If you see what I mean.
Yeah. Let's move on and talk about Martin Tyler, because I think that's more interesting. Lots of transfer gossip. The esteemed writer John Bruin wrote in The Guardian that his voice and love for the game are a constant between football eras. He's not retiring, so he'll still do lots of the world feed, just won't be at Sky. And I suppose it is interesting, you look at Jeff Stelling, John, as well. Like, you know, those people who have gone through generations of football fans. You know, there are generations of people, and I suppose he was there when I started. He probably wasn't as front and centre as Motson or Davis or Brian Moore, but he's always been there, and to have had a career this long is sort of pretty incredible.
Yeah, it is. I mean, I was asked to do the piece on Saturday morning, and yeah, the thing is with him, I remember him being back in Granada days. You know, he was the voice of Granada soccer, and then he made that, I suppose, that sort of renegade move to Sky, the satellite channel that no one really knew what was going to happen with that. And then, of course, through, let's call that fortune or whatever, he ended up as the voice of Sky and has been ever since. But it's interesting to think over his career because as I tweeted about this the other day, there are so many people convinced that Martin Tyler hates their football team. Martin Tyler does not hate your football team. And the thing is that having chatted to Martin a couple of times at matches, you know, just in a press room or whatever, there's a guy that loves football, loves, really enthusiastic about the 90 minutes ahead. And the weirdo conspiracy theories you get about these people. I think part of it is that if you're watching a match and your team loses, everything's going to irritate you. And a commentator is a constant presence in the room. And you just can't deal with that. But I think he's been at the top of his game since, I mean, he was the voice of the ITV at the 1982 World Cup. As you say, he isn't planning to step down during COVID. He got dispensations to travel around when, you know, people of his age were told pretty much to stay at home. The man just loves football and loves going to football. And he's going to be replaced by Peter Drury, who I think might be the only person who loves football more than Martin Tyler. And, you know, it's going to be interesting to see how Peter Drury comes across, because again, I've known Peter Drury a little bit at the Martin Turner. Actually, I used to work with him a few years back. Lovely guy. Again, utter enthusiasm for football. Also, very, very funny man away from the mic. But obviously, he has that sort of that almost a theatrical, bombastic style that maybe not is not to everybody's taste. But there's some great quotes there, and there'll be some great moments this time with Sky. But I do think there's a new generation of commentators coming through, isn't there? That are going to be waiting through that. Friend of the show, Seb Hutchinson, Dean Bullenstein. So, yeah, I think that scene is all going to be changing. And, of course, you've got this new TNT channel coming. So football's going to sound maybe a bit different next season. The thing I was going to say about Martin Turner is he is the voice of, if you talk of anything, it's like that Sky revolution, that sort of 90s thing. And that sort of, remember the grainy picture. Remember the sort of shoom of the replays.
Lots of flashes.
Utter hype of this sort of, you know, they're trying to sell, just basically, they're trying to sell satellite dishes for Rupert Murdoch. That's what they're trying to do. And he was Martin Turner was the sort of straight man amongst this. Obviously, he got excited about the football, but those around him, your Richard Keys, your Andy Gray, you know, everyone else is trying to push, sell, you know, get. And it was a very, if you look back on those broadcasts, it does seem quite on edge, very different to what you get now because Sky is a much more mature thing.
Yeah, I think it is also worth mentioning the thing that, you know, the moment for commentators, right? You've got to be good at all of it. You've got to be good at the kind of small talk where nothing's happening and you've got to know the game, but not necessarily offer your opinion. You know, these are those technical things, but to get the moments right. And, you know, there are just so many of them, and you wrote about it and we played them on TalkSport yesterday, you know, the Colly Moore one in the 4-3, Tony Adams, you know, can you believe it? Aguero, of course. They are sort of instinctive. They don't feel like he's written them down. You can't write them down because you'd have to write so many. What if they score in the last minute? What if they do, etc.? And he gets those right. And Drury is really interesting because I think a lot of, I think he's a great commentator, but obviously a lot of in the UK, a lot of people only see those moments, right? And, you know, and he is incredibly flamboyant and like brilliant kind of operatic delivery of those moments. And he's got, I think Barry was telling me yesterday, he's got this David Squires cartoon framed when David Squires did a Peter Drury cartoon, of which there's one frame, which is he's just sitting there, you know, with a fork in his mouth, and he's just saying, not here, not now, start to believe because this is happening. And his wife is next to him going, it's only lasagna. absolutely brilliant. Anyway, we wish him the best of luck. Well done to Graham Souness, who swam the channel and aiming to raise £1 million for charity. You've probably seen the videos of him doing it and talking about it. But for a 70-year-old, blimey, it took him 12 hours and 17 minutes. So fair play to Graham Souness. And he says, when will Max Rushton's awful controversy, which has clearly led to his social media holiday, come out? I'm guessing he's become an Arsenal fan. Now they're good again. He's hoping everyone's forgotten he's a Spurs fan by the time he comes out.
I was going to say, are you going to suddenly wash up at Partygate videos or something like that?
Yeah, there's me in braces with Jacob Rees-Mogg. Just, yeah, doing the can-can with Liz Truss. I happened to do that during COVID. I apologise. Yeah, and I'm just taking 2 months off social media. I've scheduled loads of tweets to flog the Guardian Football Weekly book, so it won't look like I'm off. I'm just not consuming it, and I'm getting producers to send out tweets on my behalf. But yeah, as Barry pointed out, it's very virtuous and pompous. I feel really good. I started reading a book yesterday.
Ooh.
Absolutely wild times. Alan says, being a long-term listener, I've noticed I've begun finishing Zoom meetings with, that'll do for today. How long, therefore, will it be before I open those meetings with on the panel today? Oh, well, look, good luck. Good luck with that, Alan. Anyway, that'll do for today's podcast. I didn't even mean to do it. But there we go. Thanks so much for coming on, Jordan.
Cheers, mate.
Thanks, John.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Lars.
Thank you, Max.
Football Weekly was produced by George Cooper. Our executive producer is Max Sanderson. We'll be back tomorrow.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work. Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.